on Van Til, his revelational presuppositionalism basically says this. You start with God as he's revealed himself in the Bible. That's your starting point. And if you argued with him and said, well, why can't I start somewhere else? He would say, because that's not true. You start with the truth. You say, well, but you're begging the question. He would say, no, you're assuming that there's something called common ground out here, that we all are in a marketplace and we can pick this off the shelf and choose. But God has revealed himself, and the God who has revealed himself is the truth, and anything else, you're starting on quicksand. You start right there with the Bible. You say, well, how do you prove that? And his response is, there are two kinds of proofs. One proof is to appeal to something beyond God in terms of which you could justify God. That would be denigrating God. That would be sacrificing the sovereignty of God. You never appeal to anything beyond God to prove God. God himself is the ultimate. But there's another kind of proof that Van Til would allow, and that's called a transcendental argument. And many of his disciples, Knudsen, Frame, others, argue that Van Til is really giving us a very famous proof, and it was a proof that was devised actually by Immanuel Kant. And the proof goes something like this. Here is what we do. Here is what man thinks. Here is what man does. Here is what everybody assumes can be done. Now let's look at what makes that necessary. What makes that possible, rather. Let's start with communication. Atheists think they can communicate. Artists think they can draw pictures. What makes drawing pictures possible? Scientists think they can observe the world. What makes all that possible? The only thing that makes all that possible is if there is a triune God who has revealed himself in the Bible. If you don't presuppose that, nothing else that even atheists and unbelievers like to do, think they can do, and engage in doing regularly, whether art, science, mathematics, communication, is even possible. Because you must presuppose the existence of the triune God revealed in the Bible as a condition for doing any of those things, and you do think you can do those things. Now, that's his argument. When it comes to borrowing common ground, whether it's historical, empirical, or logical, Van Til thinks that's totally out of place. So we want to finish why he thinks the logical is out of place, and then we'll get back to his argument as to why his argument either is valid or invalid. Look at the outline, page 1. Van Til makes many positive statements about logic. Now, by logic, we mean the basic laws of thought, like A is A, the law of identity, A is not A, the law of non-contradiction, or either A or non-A, the law of excluded middle. These basic rational laws, Van Til says, God is logical, logic is based on his nature, creation is logical, rational, there are no real contradictions in the Bible, and the laws of logic are formally the same for God and man. So far, so good. We treated that last time. Negative statements about logic. God is not subject to logic, he says. Truth is paradoxical. You can't specify the difference in the paradoxes. The content of our knowledge and God's knowledge differs. You can't argue deductively. Understanding of logical methods differs for us and for God. Man's use of logic is always wrong, and you can't argue to God or reality by logic. Now, it looks like he gave away at the left hand what he just said with the right hand, to which he would respond, no, I didn't at all, because, Roman numeral 3, logic is formally the same for God and man, but actually different. Now, if you turn to Roman numeral 3 in the quotations, we want to take a look at some of those quotations to see how he develops this point. First of all, 3a, 1 on page 6. Theism holds that all predication presupposes the existence of God as a self-conscious being, while anti-theism holds that predication is possible without any reference to God. This at once gives to the term is and is not quite different connotations. For the anti-theist, these terms play against the background of bare possibility. Hence, is and is not may very well be reversed. The anti-theist has in effect denied the very law of contradiction, inasmuch as the law of non-contradiction, to operate at all, must have its foundation in the nature of God. If then there is such a fundamentally exclusive difference of opinion on the question as to what the law of contradiction itself is between theist and non-theist, it is quite out of the question to speak of the law of contradiction as something that all men agree upon. All men do agree upon it as a formal principle, but the two classes of men differ on the question of its foundation and application. Now, here he brings together everything we've just said up to this point. One, the law of non-contradiction is understood differently by God than it is by men. So differently that when we say is, it may actually be is not for God. So it may be the exact reverse for God. When God says is, we would say is not. Proof. They're atheists. Now, obviously, if they're atheists, and God says he is, and there is a God and he is, and atheists say he is not, and atheists think they're rational, and they're using the law of non-contradiction, and God is rational, and he's using the law of non-contradiction, somebody's wrong. Guess who? The atheist. It's Van Til's argument. Any questions or comments on that point before we jump in a little deeper? All right, take the second quotation, 3A2, on your outline. Paradoxes are inevitable. A word must here be said about the question of antinomies. Now, an antinomy, paradox, is a contradiction. For philosophers and theologians in the history of the use of this term, this means a logical contradiction. It will readily be inferred what, as Christians, we mean by antinomies. They're involved in the fact that human knowledge can never be completely comprehensive knowledge. Every knowledge transaction has in it somewhere a reference point to God. Now, since God is not fully comprehensible to us, we are bound to come into what seems to be contradictions in all of our knowledge. Our knowledge is analogical and therefore must be paradoxical. We say that if there is to be any true knowledge at all, there must be in God an absolute system of knowledge. We therefore insist that everything must be related to that absolute system of knowledge, yet we ourselves cannot fully understand the system. Now, if God is absolute, and whatever he knows absolutely, and if God only has the perfect system, and we are in a world in which our logic is at odds with him, then our knowledge is going to be at odds with him. It's inevitable. You cannot avoid paradoxes because we are finite and he is infinite, and his infinite knowledge is the system. Our finite knowledge is at odds with the system. Therefore, in our system, we're going to end up in logical contradictions. The way we think, the way we use logic, is going to be contradictory. But to God, it's not contradictory at all. Parallel lines meet in infinity. I'm sure Van Til would like the Riemannian math at that point and say what doesn't apply here, what seems to be parallel here is really absolutely one in him, because he's the infinite point, and in infinity all of these things meet. Any question about that? What Van Til means so far? Okay, 3A3. Understanding of logic differs for man and God. It was necessary to emphasize the universality of prejudice at this point, because it will thus become clear that when the Christian and his opponent use the same terminology, they do not mean the same things. Both speak of inductive, deductive, and transcendental methods, but each of them presupposes his own starting point when he uses these terms. And that fact gives these terms a different meaning in each case. It follows from this, too, that what the Christian is opposing is not these methods as such, but the anti-Christian presuppositions at the base of them. Your presupposition will color all the use of your methods. So it's not a question of saying the Christian uses logic, the non-Christian uses logic. They each have different presuppositions, and that will determine the results of the use of those presuppositions. You cannot use even logic and assume that a Christian is using logic in the same way as a non-Christian is. They are diametrically opposed. The Christian uses it the way God does, as he's revealed himself in the Scripture. You have to have an absolute reference point for all knowledge. God is the absolute reference point. Humans only have a relative reference point, therefore no way for humans to avoid coming into paradoxes in their understanding. Now, behind all of this is his view of the sovereignty of God and the depravity of man. How so? We've discussed a few of his quotes here, tried to explain what he means. Now you tell me how the sovereignty of God and the depravity of man are really behind what he is saying here. All right, and how does the sovereignty of God relate? We need his help. That's a weak way to put it. The only way we could possibly understand anything is if God revealed it, and that's where the absolute truth is. So God, as he's revealed himself in Scripture, the triune God, is the absolute starting point for all of our knowledge. If you start anywhere else, you're in sinking sand. How is that a transcendental argument? What is a transcendental argument? That sounds just like pure fideism, doesn't it? Sounds like Allah has revealed himself in the Quran. You got to start here. If you don't start with Allah in the Quran, you are in sinking sand. To which Van Til would respond, how?
The Quran is wrong.
Quran is wrong, but how can you show that the Quran is wrong? As it's contradictory, but that you wouldn't want to press that too far for Van Til. From our standpoint, it is contradictory, but from their standpoint, it isn't. Revelation is self-vindicating, but how do you bring his transcendental proof in? What is a transcendental proof? How can he transcendentally, or attempt to transcendentally prove his point, and he thinks a Muslim couldn't prove his point? And this will get at the heart of the issue. Let's start with, what is a transcendental argument? A transcendental argument goes like this. You and I are communicating. What makes that possible? What are the grounds that make communication possible? Well, we'll just think of a few of them now. There has to be a mind here and a mind there. I mean, we're presupposing two minds. Otherwise, there's no communication. We're also presupposing what else to make communication possible? We're presupposing that there is a meaningful medium that we both share. In this case, it's language, verbal language. And there are a lot of other things, too. But no communication would be possible unless those two things were there. Those are the absolutely necessary grounds for communication. Now, a transcendental argument goes this way. If this can be done, if you suppose this can be done, then you must suppose this as the condition for doing it. If you and I suppose that communication is occurring, then we must presuppose that there's a mind on each end and there's a medium that we both share that can convey thoughts from one mind to the other. Otherwise, otherwise no communication is occurring, right? That's a transcendental argument. Positing the necessary preconditions for doing something that we both agree can be and is being done. I want to take science, art, literature, anything that human beings do, atheists, eating food, you take anything you want and show me why there must be a God as the necessary preconditions for doing this. Or think of any of the people we studied up to this point. Does anybody else have an argument similar to this that we've covered? You could think of any of the arguments in that context, but well, I'm thinking of one in particular that is very, very similar to a transcendental argument, and that is Augustine's argument from truth. You remember that one? 7 + 3 = 10, there are absolute truths. Now, what's the condition for having an absolute truth? You have to have an absolute mind. Truth is an idea. Ideas exist only in mind. Absolute ideas exist only if there are absolute minds as a condition for them. So in a sense, Augustine's argument from truth is a kind of transcendental argument. It is necessary to postulate an absolute mind if there is any such thing as absolute thoughts. There are absolute thoughts, 7 + 3 = 10, therefore there must be an absolute mind. Now, you're getting the feel of how a transcendental argument works, because if you don't get the feel of how it works, what we're going to do next is wrong. So stop me here if you don't think you have a handle on a transcendental argument.
Can you say like this? I mean, if you're going to do art and I'm going to do science, you take mind to do art and science. And the person behind our mind is God. And can you bring it back up that way?
Yeah. That's right. Or just take art. What does all art have in common? Beauty. What does all beauty have in common? Order. Let's not argue about these for the sake of argument now. Let's agree. And that's a reasonable hypothesis. What makes order possible? If the atheists were right, this is just a random universe. Everything happened by chance. There's no basis for doing art. There's no basis for anything. Everything we do, everything human beings do, whether we communicate, you're ordering letters together on a page when you write. You're ordering pigments together in a canvas when you paint. Everything we do is ordering. That's the essence of rationality, is to give order to something. It's embarrassing when I think of the top of my desk, but at any rate, I don't know why that came to my mind right then. You can draw your own conclusions of what might follow from that. But order is the essence of rationality. Order exists in everything. The atheist assumes order. He assumes natural law. What is natural law? An ordered, repeated regularity that he sees in nature. In fact, he assumes that's all there is. He doesn't assume any supernatural. But how can there be order if there is no ultimate basis for order? You must postulate, well, Van Til's right, isn't he? Yes. Oh, you say, well, so far so good. How are we doing on the Muslim and Van Til argument so far? Who's winning? They're equal so far. That's right. That's exactly right. They're equal. Why are they equal? They're both based on, all we've proven is some ordered intelligence behind the universe. They both agree to that. So we've got this ordered intelligence. Now here we have a Quran, and here we have a Bible. Over here we have the Christian triune God. And here we have an absolutely monotheistic God. This God has one and only one person. And this God has three persons in one, which I like to diagram 1 to the 3rd power. 1 × 1 × 1 = 1. Not 1 + 1 + 1. That's tritheism. We've got a triune God who's revealed himself in the Bible, and we have a monotheistic God who's revealed himself in the Quran, and out here we have things like science and art and language and all of the wonderful things we do, ethics, and everything else. And so far, the transcendental argument has not proven the Bible over the Quran, or it's not proven the triune God over monotheism. It's just proven that there must be some intelligent being out there as the grounds for doing it. What's Van Til's next move? His next move is a very significant one. It's called the problem of the one and the many. The problem of the one and the many is one of the most perplexing problems in the history of philosophy. You can put it many ways, but basically it goes like this. There is manyness and there is oneness. How can the two relate? The absolute monist will say that this is real and this is unreal. That's what a monist would say. A pluralist would say, well, this really is unreal and this is real. Now, other than the radical pluralist who says there's only manyness but there's really no actual oneness, and the radical monist who says there's really only oneness and everything that seems to be manyness doesn't exist. Other than those two radical groups, everybody else believes there's some reality in oneness and there's some reality in manyness. In fact, Van Til would argue transcendentally, there must be some kind of manyness because we assume we're communicating. So there must be at least two minds, yours and mine. And yet there must be ultimately one mind, God, as the condition for our two minds thinking. Now, how do you ultimately relate the one and the many? Van Til's answer is the only ultimate solution to the one and the many is the Trinity. Because in the Trinity, you have the paradigm example of how there's one and many in one being. Here is one God, and yet there's manyness. There are three persons. So the Trinity is the only solution to the philosophical puzzle of the one and the many. Without a Trinity, you cannot explain how the universe has both plurality and unity. But it must have plurality, or we wouldn't be able to communicate with each other. We're obviously plural beings. It must have unity, or there wouldn't be any basis for it. So it's transcendentally necessary for the universe to have both manyness and oneness. But ultimately, each other, we're obviously plural beings. It must have unity, or there wouldn't be any basis for it. So it's transcendentally necessary for the universe to have both manyness and oneness. But ultimately, this manyness and oneness must have a oneness itself. God is the three in one. The Trinity answers the problem of the one and the many. So Van Til would say, we just showed why the Quran can't do it, because they can explain oneness, but they can't explain manyness. Incidentally, there's a very interesting historical footnote that would tend to support Van Til's conclusion. Monotheism historically tended to go into pantheism. In fact, when the Muslims turned philosophical, their philosophers often became pantheist. Baha'i is a good example. Baha'i is a sect, really Muslims. Baha'u'llah was reared in Islam and succeeded him in the sense that he thought he was the latter prophet than Muhammad, but he has a pantheistic concept of God. The whole Middle Ages, Averroes, the Averroians in the Middle Ages, were really pantheistic Muslims who were influencing Christianity, and hence Thomas Aquinas tried to answer them and did successfully answer them and turned the tide against it. And his book, Summa Contra Gentiles, was a missionary handbook for the missionaries in Spain who were influenced by the Moors. I mean, by the way, another interesting footnote. Why is there an element of fatalism in Spanish culture? it's because of the influence of the Muslims through the Moors in Spain. And that element of fatalism came by way of the pantheism, by way of the Muslim view, if Allah will. Remember Omar Khayyam's famous poem, "'Tis all a checkerboard of night and days, where destiny with men is pieces plays, hither and thither, checks and mates and slays, and one by one back in the closet lays." Well, we're all pawns on a checkerboard. God is the great chess player, and he's pushing us where we want. It's an extreme form of Calvinism, extreme form of fatalism, if you will. So, we answered the Muslim. We answered that, and we established the triune God. Van Til's right. He's right on both points. He's right on the transcendental necessity, and he's right, isn't he, that you have to have three in one in order to explain this problem. No. He's right on the first one, and he's wrong on the second one. And the second one is where his fideism comes in. And I'd like to mention two reasons why he's wrong on the second one. He's absolutely right to presuppose that there must be some ultimate mind behind meaning in the universe. But he has no transcendental reason, no argument as to why you have to have three persons and one God. And that for two reasons. One, two persons in one God would do it. Or four, or five, or 55 persons in one God would do the same trick. Why does he say three? Pure faith. He believes the Bible without a transcendental argument. That's where his fideism comes in. That's why it is justified to say Van Til is a fideist in some sense of the word. He simply believes by faith that the Bible is true when it says there are three persons in one God. There's no place else in you. You can't get that from transcendentally looking at the stars. You can't get that from any argument. You get that only from your faith tradition that there are three persons in one God. And if you believe that, then of course that will fit with what you're doing. But transcendentally, two persons in one God would do the same thing. Or 5, or 10, or 77. That's the first element of faith for which he has no transcendental argument as to why there have to be three persons in God. That he accepts by pure faith. Any question on that point before we go to the next one? Secondly, the problem of the one and the many is not solved by saying that in God there are three persons and only one person. That doesn't solve the problem. Why? Because really, here is someone trying to show the ultimate meaningfulness, the ultimate basis for all meaning in the universe is a triune God, three persons in one person, and the ultimate statement of it is contradictory. The ultimate statement is three persons in one person. He's not talking about three persons in one nature. That's the traditional way of saying the Trinity. That's not a contradiction. One essence in God and three persons. To diagram it in contrast, the Orthodox way of putting it and Van Til's way of putting it, the Orthodox way is, of course, the three who's and the one what in God. Three different persons and one what. What Van Til is saying is in God you have three who's in one who. Now, by any standard ever articulated as orthodox by anyone from the first century to the present, that is not an orthodox way of stating the Trinity. Is not only not orthodox, not biblical, but it is contradictory, since Van Til says there is no way to distinguish the difference between who used here and who used here. Who, so far as we can tell, has the same meaning used in the center as over here. Or we're saying who is different than what. You have one what, and you have three different who's, And there's a difference between the who and the what. There are three persons all sharing the same essence. That's a mystery, but it's not a contradiction. This is a contradiction. So at the very heart of his system is a contradiction, to which he replies, if he were here, what? That's your logic. Now, what do you say in response to him?
What about
this? Huh?
What did he get his logic? He said our logic.
Okay, that's a legitimate way to respond. His logic, the ultimate answer to that is what? His logic is God's logic, and your logic is your logic.
Yeah, you got two people who are believers, both claiming God on their side. I mean, you can posit anything you want.
Now, where are we back to, though? When he gives that answer, we're back to pure faith, fideism. He's pure dogmatism. He is assuming his logic is God's logic, and your logic isn't God's logic. And that, of course, is the ultimate in arrogance and dogmatism, or it is at least petitio principi. It's a gigantic begging the question. It's another way to put it, the problem that Van Til has, and that's this. He's really saying that logic, as we understand it, does not apply to God. Logic, as we understand it, does not apply to God. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with making statements like logic does not apply to God? Everything I hear is true, but nobody really knocked him out. Nobody really gave him a lethal blow. Right, you're getting warmer. Right, it's ultimately self-defeating, isn't it? Self-defeating because this very statement, logic does not apply to God, is a logical statement about God. The very statement, logic does not apply to God, is a logical statement about God. Surely it's not a contradictory statement about God. Surely he's not offering it as a dumb, absurd, contradictory statement about God. He's offering it as a true, logical, rational, non-contradictory statement about God. But if the statement is a logical statement about God, saying that you cannot make logical statements about God, he may as well have said, I do not exist. You have to exist in order to say it. He may as well have said, I cannot speak a word in English. It's equally self-defeating to those two statements. I cannot speak a word in English is a word in English to tell you that I cannot speak a word in English. I do not exist is I'm existing to tell you I don't exist. And logic does not apply to God is a logical statement about God. Now there's a slippery way that they tend to try and get out of this, and it's like this. Logic may apply to finite reality, but logic does not apply to infinite reality equals God. And how would you respond to that distinction? Van Til said, well, sure, logic applies to reality, applies to finite reality. You can do that. You can go to the store and say, this is soup, and soup is not non-soup, and this is bread, and bread is not non-bread. But you can't do that when you come to the Trinity. When you come to the Trinity, you're talking about infinite reality, and that's three is one, and one is three up there. Down here, three is three, and one is one. But up there, three is one, and one is three. How do you respond? What?
postpone the question. Which... Okay, number two is exactly the same thing as we just went through. Number two, logic does not apply to infinite reality equals, this is a logical statement about infinite reality. Same thing. We just write second verse like unto the first. A little bit longer, a little bit worse. Just a little more subtle, a little more clever. It's now saying logic doesn't apply to infinite reality, which is a logical statement about infinite reality. Do you recognize anybody here? Kant. Where was Van Til trained? Amsterdam. Where is Amsterdam? See, the whole German mentality, the whole German-Dutch mentality springs out of Kant, and everything in the continent has been heavily influenced by Kant, and Dewey Weerd's whole philosophy goes right back to Kant. Dewey Weerd talks about sphere sovereignty. That's just adding a Calvinistic flavor to Kant by saying all of these little revelatory spheres down here don't really tell you about the numeral up there about God. So add a little total depravity, divine sovereignty to Kant's gulf, and you have Dewey Weerd and then Van Til that follows from that. All right, any question about Van Til? Yes.
Fully?
No, in this life. See, there's nothing wrong with saying there is something wrong with saying I can't know anything about infinite reality. That's self-defeating. There's nothing self-defeating about saying I can know something about infinite reality. But if you say...
Yeah, it's based on revelation.
All truth comes from revelation. Whether general or natural revelation. I'll grant you or anyone who wants to argue the point that it's based on revelation. The question is whether or not there's any justification for believing in that revelation. See, the ultimate difference between a presuppositionalist, back to our first chart here, of the revelatory category and evidentialist, and for that matter even the other people over here, the rational and the systematic coherence one, is not whether we have presuppositions. It's not whether we believe in revelation. The ultimate difference is this. Is our revelatory starting point self-authenticating, or is it arguable? Can you adjudicate conflicts between two different revelatory claims? And at first it looked like Van Til could. See, his first transcendental argument was good. I mean, I think that's a good way to adjudicate conflicts between atheists and theists. Transcendental argument. There's got to be some meaningful basis for this, or you couldn't do science. Blah, blah, blah. So far, so good. Then when you get back to three persons in one God and revealed in the Bible, you've long left your transcendental argument, and you're going by sheer faith. Now the question is, do you have any grounds to justify your belief the Bible is true as opposed to the Quran, or there are three persons and one God as opposed to only one person? Now if you say none whatsoever, then we just stand on our two hills and shout at each other. If you say there's common ground, and we can all use it, reason and evidence, and of course you're no longer Van Tilian because there is no common ground that we can all go to, then you're a classical apologist. Any thoughts on... Yes?
You said that historically, Trinitarians protected the Bible.
yet. No, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to imply that at all. I said the opposite. I said that monotheism tended not to be protected against pantheism. I don't. Yes, I think there are two things, and you mentioned one. The one thing, of course, is that the creator-creature distinction. That in and of itself would protect a view, even if there weren't three persons in God. The radical difference between creature and creator, necessary being, contingent being. Secondly, yes, I think there's something about Trinitarianism per se, apart from any radical distinction that protects against pantheism, because Trinitarianism admits a real plurality in God, and a pantheist cannot admit that. A pantheist, ultimately, everything is one and one person, and everything merges. So the very fact, suppose you have God before he ever created, and he's a triune God. You know right there that it's not a pantheistic God. If it's not a triune God, how can you tell right there before he created, and you can see something is absolutely disjunct from him, that he's not a pantheistic God? So I'm arguing that God in and of himself, before he created or apart from creation, if it's a triune God, is already inbuilt impossibility of being conceived pantheistically. Is it necessary for there to be a Trinity for him to have created a what?
Plurality.
Of things? As opposed to just one thing?
The fact that we see many in creation depends in some way on the Trinity.
I would rather use the word reflective than dependent. Sure. Right.
So that would seem to divorce the creator-creature aspect from God's Trinity.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. I think for two reasons. One is because Trinitarianism historically has been identified with the volitional creation and therefore the contingency of a created world. And two, and that's the only one that has a logical connection, that when you already have a plurality in God, there's an inbuilt protection against conceiving that pantheistically. There's no way you can conceive of a Trinitarian God as pantheistic, because pantheistic God by nature is absolutely one with no duality or plurality at all. But the interesting thing there is what? Even in the most fundamental statement of their monotheism, the Lord our God is one, ekad. It's a word, it's the same word that was used of male and female are one. You got a plurality and unity. Same word used of the grapes that they took from the promised land. One bundle of grapes, many grapes. It's not a very rigid word. It's not a very rigid one. And you have the Elohim. You have the plural forms. And you can talk all you want about royal plural and all that. It still is interesting that the form is plural. It still is interesting that God says, let us make man in our own image. You have these intimations of the Trinity. Now, I'm not saying the Old Testament teaches the Trinity. Well, I'm certainly saying that the language that is used of that kind of monotheism would in no way lead someone to be so rigid that they couldn't possibly have a Trinity come out of that.